Thin Digital Line, policing in the year 2045.
Hello, I'm Jason Harwin, and welcome to the latest episode of Thin Digital Line. During this series, we're exploring how the world of digital data and technology will have an impact on policing by the year 2045. I'm delighted and privileged today to be joined by two members of the National Police Chiefs Council. Firstly, Temporary Chief Constable Alex Murray, who's the National Lead for Artificial Intelligence. Hello, Alex.
Hi.
Secondly, Chief Constable Chris Howard, who's the National Lead for Serious and Organised Crime. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Jason.
And last but not least, Alistair Hendry, Executive Director from the award-winning digital transformation company, Exception.
Hello.
So today we're going to be talking all about artificial intelligence, we're going to talk about surveillance, and we're also going to talk about balancing the liberty of individuals living in our communities as well. To get started, Alex, do you want to explain to us what artificial intelligence means to policing at the moment?
Yeah, thanks. And this is a problem with definitions, but ultimately it's machine that learns or generalizes or infers meaning from data to replicate and sometimes enhance what a human being can do. In essence, what it really is there's a load of data, there's a load of processing power, there's generally an algorithm, and then there's a human that's understanding it to improve our performance. And as you know, AI is already everywhere, both in policing and in the wider society. But I think we're beginning to move into some of the more interesting areas, ChatGPT births, for example, particularly around issues of forecasting and things like that.
So in terms of that, and again, let's be honest, if you listen to any podcast at the moment, artificial intelligence is a common one that lots of people are talking about. And recognising we're going to pilot ourselves to 2045 very shortly. Hopefully we're all looking as young as we are now, but we're going to go to 2045. But in terms of what policing's doing now around artificial intelligence, can you just tell the listeners what we're actually looking at the moment from a policing perspective?
I like to categorise it into sort of three areas. One is around productivity improvement. Now, this has been going on for a long time, but you can think some of the basics. Some people wouldn't even say it's AI, but robotic process automation, algorithms that move data around in a way that replicates what a human does. That drives productivity gains already right now. Then there's the second area, which I call a sort of improving effectiveness of policing. Now, that might be, for example, live facial recognition that we have now. We already have automatic number plate readers that are reading images and telling us information. And already people are beginning to experiment with large data sets where we can forecast where our attention should be based. For example, we want to prevent crime. Going right back to the genesis of policing, Robert Peel said our success should be measured by the crime we prevent as well as what we solve. And already cops try and think about, okay, who's our main burglars? You know, who's the rapists? Who's going to be involved in domestic abuse? And currently there are some forces looking at how we can use the data we own on AI to better forecast where we should focus our attention, for example, on which offenders to better prevent harm in the future. The third sort of pillar, I would say, is how we counter the criminal use of AI. And that could be generative AI for child abuse imagery, or it could be fraud chatbots. The options are endless. So I think our focus is in those three areas. And in all of those three areas, police are moving quicker and quicker.
So there's been lots of debate. Is it evolution or revolution? What's your view?
I think it's evolution, but Mohamed Suleiman in his book, The Wave, helpfully described that change will never be as slow as it is today. And I think for AI, we should think about that when we think, oh, this is called getting out of control and going a bit fast. I think that is only going to speed up and we need to be really agile, particularly if we're to protect the communities.
Okay, thank you. And Chris, linked into the bit around the third element about targeting serious and organised crime, and obviously as the national lead for surveillance and whilst not compromising operational tactics, very sensitive around that. But how has policing changed over the last 10 years then in terms of how we gather intelligence, securing evidence and use of surveillance?
Yeah, I think it fits very well with what Alex just said, is that if you look back at surveillance 10 years ago, it was very much a boots on ground, human resource led activity. A lot of the intelligence we focused on was basically driven by human beings and that connectivity with the communities and the intelligence coming through there. Over the last decade, you've seen it move more into an automated space, predictive analytics to try and say, actually, this is what the lifestyle looks like of the individuals we're targeting and surveilling. And actually, that helps us be more productive around when we deploy teams on the ground. So we're using them much more effectively. I think as time moves on in the organised crime world, we'll probably move to a much more data-driven surveillance community. We're seeing more and more use of technology rather than human beings. And likewise, the criminal groups that we're actually targeting are using AI and machine learning to actually commit their crimes, which makes it really critical that we actually keep pace with that. So Alex's point about the pace of change and whether we're being too slow is a critical point that we've got to discuss and work our way through over, particularly with a new government coming in.
And in terms of obviously getting the benefits of artificial intelligence in terms of investigation, is there any thoughts you've got at the minute where there's obvious where we could get more from it, whether it be now or in the future?
So I think the starting point is very much what Alex said, is that the productivity is critical. You know, we've got masses of data coming in. We've probably got more data than we can actually cope with. Well, we have got more data than we can cope with. So we've got to do something that automates the warehousing of that, the collection of that, the organising of it, and then importantly, the analytical product that comes from it, so that we're identifying where the offences are coming from, who the offenders are. So even where you've got people who might otherwise fall under the threshold because their one-off criminality is at a level that wouldn't normally get picked up. What we're seeing now through automated intelligence and that data analytics piece is we're picking up offenders who otherwise had crept under the radar, but what we're seeing is volume of offences coming through, albeit each offence in its own right has been relatively small. So it's starting to put together pieces that we haven't otherwise seen. We're seeing a lot more in terms of child sexual exploitation and mass exploitation, so machine-driven exploitation and grooming of children, and you see it in the fraud space as well and cyber attacks. This is no longer one individual talking to a child or committing an offence against an elderly person. This is one individual with multiple bots effectively doing the work for them and generating that work. So how do you target and how do you surveil against that when it may just be a machine that's actually doing the criminal act?
And we'll come to that shortly about policing role and responsibilities. Alistair, I'm keen to get your view. Obviously, looking from outside policing in and what you're seeing in other private and public sector, what's happening around artificial intelligence outside policing?
There's a couple of points around things that have been said already, but when private sector organisations are absolutely trying to get the business gain and business benefits of AI, trying to get the efficiencies that you guys have been talking about, I think it's worth highlighting Alex's point about, well, yes, it's moving quickly, but I would argue we're not actually at AI yet. We're at very clever algorithms that are telling us what they think we want to hear rather than anything else. So we've got a long way until we're into the AI space and lots more data to consume. But where businesses are looking at optimization and improving cost reduction, all those kind of things, all those apply to criminals in the same way. And that's where the main problem comes from.
Taking account of where we are now, and again, some of you may be well aware of this, a gentleman by the name of Ray Kurzweils obviously has predicted that by 2045, through artificial intelligence technology, you'll have the brain of a human being and actually be able to do more than that, actually be able to, again, copy the movements and voice of individuals as well. Clearly, that presents some opportunity and risk to policing. And what's your views around that, Alex, in terms of 2045? If that prediction was to be correct, what do you see in impacting on policing?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? He is like a real expert in this field, so we need to take what he says very seriously. But I do look at a number of companies going back a decade around what they forecasted were going to happen now. And a lot of that hasn't come to pass. So we should be relatively cynical. And for those people who are involved in evaluating AI interventions, there's a thing called a confusion matrix. And a confusion matrix says, how effective is this AI at forecasting? What's the false positives? What's the false negatives? What's the true negatives and the true positives? We've never applied a confusion matrix to a futurist before, but if we did, it would be very interesting to understand all the false and positive predictions they made, and that's no disrespect to him at all. It will clearly be a game changer between now and 2045. There's a thing called narrow AI, which is the space we're in at the moment, and that might be one of the reasons why Alistair is saying I'm not sure we found AI yet. But then we've got general AI, which is the sort of idea that where people want to go to, where a machine has the ability to evaluate, plan and execute that plan effectively without any human interaction, the same as or even better than a human. Some people refer to it as the new Turing test. And a helpful analogy I've seen is that you say to Amazon, here's £1 million, go and make me £1.5 million. And it goes away, it orders everything, it sells it all, and it comes back 1 year later making you £500,000, for example. That would be AGI, and it's beyond our reach at the moment. I think by 2045, we may be going close to that. And so you could imagine a computer, a machine that, let's just use the example of burglary, very conventional. Who knows what that will look like in 2045, but it notices the trends, it speaks to the victims, it highlights the model around where we should focus on, it dispatches, sends images. You know, all of that is done without a a human. What I am 100% sure of is that in 2045, police officers, men and women, will still be at the heart of everything we do, because we will still be going to incidents of violence that need a human to interact, incidents of domestic abuse and child abuse and public order. I can never see a time when that will go away, much as the science fiction writers would like to think of the place overrun by robots. And I guess the final point I'd make is that people see this space beyond artificial general intelligence around artificial super intelligence. And this is where basically the machines begin to completely think for themselves. And that is far off in the future, if ever. And some people even question whether we can get to the AGI space. But what is for sure is that things will change.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. So, Chris, just in turn, you touched on some of the challenges already around artificial intelligence. But what do you see some of the opportunities going forward around it in terms of crime prevention and everything else?
So I think they're two sides of the same coin. So what you've got on one hand is criminal use and exploitation of new data tooling. And I agree with Alistair, this is probably more about machine learning algorithms and just automating things rather than the actual sentient being of computers. But actually, there's still a human in the background exploiting that and using that to their advantage. I think if you turn that coin over, you've got the same opportunities. And actually, from a policing point of view, again, I agree with Alex here, is that you're still going to need men and women in the background who can actually put these systems in place, develop the systems that actually counter the threat that we're experiencing. So we have the capability, we have the knowledge, and we have the skills. The question will be, is can we do this at volume and can we do this at scale? And can we target criminals who are exploiting people in the tens of thousands in whatever crime type they have? Can we actually try and prevent the movement of money? Because ultimately, this is always about profit. Whichever crime type you look at, apart from violence, it's generally about profit. So can we counter that and can we stop the money flowing, given that most of this in the future will all be online and it will be crypto and things like that? So I do believe we can do that. We've got the capability to do it. We've just got to make sure that we invest in the right technology and that we do it as a collective, as a nation, and we're thinking about the best tooling we can get. But I think we've also got to go back to the Peelian principles. This is still the responsibility of the whole community. This is still everybody in the country has a responsibility to try and prevent this, to report it, and to work together to keep our people safe and our communities safe, particularly the most vulnerable in society, who at this point in time are the ones who are being targeted. And I would imagine that will only get bigger over the next 20 years if we don't do something now to change that cultural attitude. So, well, if it's happening online, I don't need to worry about it. Absolutely we do. And I think there's a cultural shift that we've got to work on as well.
Chris, I'd just be interested. You talk about us as a nation having to act to respond to SOC. But, you know, international, online, serious organised crime, we think about some of the countries that are involved and where people hide their money. It's now much more international. And I'm interested in your view of how that becomes an international response.
Yeah, it is, Alex. And that's going to be a real challenge. So I think you can see a lot more cooperation going on between like-minded nations. I think there's always going to be challenges between different nations, and I'm not going to start naming them, but I think we all know where those tensions would be. But in the serious and organised crime space, there are increasing bilateral agreements between UK and US. There's work going on with Europe now to look at our intelligence sharing, data sharing and automation around this and sharing the skills. And you've got the same across other partners and across the globe. So I think everybody accepts that this has to be done by a number of nations together. And we've got to look at how we corral our resources, I think, to have the greatest effect. And a lot of that's going to be about how we share the data, how we then analyse that data and how we exploit it. But also, where's the jurisdictional footprint? So if we need to operate in Europe, how's that going to work, particularly where you're looking at servers and online services? It's the same in the United States. So what are those agreements going to be? So you're going to have those challenges around jurisdiction and new legislation, as well as you're going to have the ethical challenges around. So if you've got global exploitation, what does mass surveillance look like online, and what's the code of ethics that might sit behind that, and how are we going to use it? But yeah, Alex, I agree. This needs wider cooperation and collaboration and cultural change than just the UK.
So, Alex, I know there's been some work done already around how we apply artificial intelligence, because as you say, it's already out there, except in the degree is a lot less than it may be and will be in the future. But just for listeners, in terms of what the police are doing now around, again, safeguarding to make sure we're applying certain principles, ethical decision making, can you just talk the listeners through what some of the things you're doing as the lead for artificial intelligence around that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as you say, everyone is using it to a certain extent already, often around the productivity space. So interpreting different languages, for example, facial recognition, either live or retrospective, ANPR, all of those sorts of things. And it is so important that the police are seen as legitimate. Without legitimacy, you know, the public won't cooperate, empower or comply with policing. And they need to know without a shadow of a doubt that the motivation of the police is to best protect communities and no other reason whatsoever. And so one of my roles, I think, as national lead is to create a responsible AI framework that you can interpret locally or nationally, depending on whether it's an AI intervention that is delivered locally or nationally. And it's worth saying we already have the NPCC covenant in AI that all chief constables are signed up to, which says if you're going to use AI, it must be lawful, transparent, explainable, responsible, and robust. You know, I trained on good data. We need to take that a stage further. And when you're using AI, you know, it's no disrespect to a force chaplain or someone like that, but they're not the ones to sit on an ethics committee in relation to AI. You need to understand algorithms, as I mentioned before, what language is used, how the model is trained, what the level of false positives are, how the human police officer or police staff is receiving that data, and what they're told and how they're told to interpret that data. So I don't think anyone can manage ethics in this space. You need to have guidance. And one of the things, in fact, I've got my second AI board tomorrow, will be is commissioning that piece of work so that if I'm a local chief constable, I can say, okay, here's the sort of questions I need to ask. And really, we want to take communities with us. How do we involve communities in sort of supervising that ethical decision-making and involving them as well?
And Alistair, from your side again, looking from outside policing in, your thoughts on potential implications for policing from, again, use of artificial intelligence elsewhere in the sector?
Yeah, I mean, the framing we've talked about there is, you know, it's a really good example of how AI hasn't progressed far enough. It can't make that decision-making process on, you know, it can get distracted by things or give hallucinations back to various questions. But from a private sector point of view, the speed at which AI and the money put into AI at the moment is just vast. And it's moving incredibly quickly. But I think the bit that'll be really interesting from our point of view is we're seeing the kind of big bubble, the Microsofts, the Amazons, the, you know, Googles, all of these kind of guys really push it. What we're also seeing on the kind of sidelines is the open source side of this. Now, the open source side is where people are generating their own models without the control of bias, without the weightings that we might put in other models. And I think that would expose a little more to the criminal side of things, where we can maybe, you know, those models end up on dark web. They then get affected. They then become a bigger problem. You know, those two sides are what we're seeing on the private sector, which I think falls directly into the police problem.
Can I just come in? Because I think police forces sometimes, if they're not careful, and sometimes, you know, early adopters of PCs or DCs will see a little application they can download, and before you know it, statements are being written for them. But we call it the black box. So they don't know where that data is being stored. And that's a concern I have. And one of the other things I'll be working with chiefs on is guidance for when to use an AI application, when you know it's safe and when it's not, going back to the covenant on AI.
Yeah, because I think it's a really important point around the trust element of this. If you start using AI and we lose the trust element because of misinformation, that's when the whole thing starts to break down and it will have a major impact on the whole innovation moving forward.
I think there's another point here as well, is there is a tendency to find these little pockets going on and people just deploying new technology because it does something that improves their productivity. I think there's a fine balance here between encouraging innovation within policing and within our staff, but having some way where that innovation can be implemented or taken to true embedding in policing on a national level where it's the right thing to do. Because there are a number where, Alex is right, actually, we don't want those small pockets of innovation being done on their own where it just fragments the policing approach, but we do need to see where it's working so we can then expand that and scale it at speed. And I think it's that point of from innovation and inception to implementation that is going to be a challenge for policing. I think that's probably where we've got to think about our own structures, but we've probably also got to think about professional services that might be able to help us in terms of developing that and moving that forward, which goes back to my point around this is not policing alone, this is partners, this is private sector, this is professional services who can help kind of bring this to be.
Chris made a really good point. And I want to encourage local innovation as long as it operates within some transparent guidance, because there'll be loads of failures. And I don't think AI is something you can command and control from the centre. And in fact, you know, for every 10 interventions, probably there'll be one that is brilliant, that, as Chris says, we need to scale up and then roll out nationally. The way that Lindsay in London, for example, has worked on live facial recognition, very good. Demonstrated purpose, really concerned around ethics, really good community engagement, working with the Alan Turing Institute. And so we go, okay, now we've proved the point, how do you scale up the use of that, for example? And I know Avon and Somerset, Beds, many, many forces have got little interventions that are just brilliant, that as long as they stick with a covenant, that we can take and say, okay, let's expand.
So in terms of the role of the police then, Alex, and obviously policing artificial intelligence, do you see it as the police responsibility, or is there other views?
That's a really good question. And I'm interested in Chris's view on this, but it's a bit like surveillance, and it's a bit like intrusive surveillance, where depending on the type of AI you're using, I think we've got a covenant and you can say, yes, we stick by that covenant. But when you are involved in AI that involves more people with greater impact, it should be subject to external scrutiny. It should be open and it should be transparent, and we should have community engagement. In extreme cases, it should be subject to external authorization as well. So there's a sliding scale. We can be responsible for some of it, but as it grows and becomes more impactful, more powerful, with a greater impact, then we should invest an equal and opposite amount of time taking communities with us. And if that requires external scrutiny and even authorization, then I think it should. Very few police officers want to live in a police state. I think it's okay being regulated to a certain extent in around some of the more intrusive uses of AI, because we want the public to know that it's safe and that our motivations are good.
There's an interesting point around that, where America's been looking at, you know, potentially creating a body that authorizes the use of AI models prior to them going into a production environment, and, you know, taking that kind of hardline approach. That almost stops and stifles innovation, because it's not those ones you need to monitor, it's the other ones made on the sidelines in the other countries that are going to be the issue.
But I think that's about the production of AI with the companies and whether it can go into mainstream purchasing, isn't it? I think the point we're on here is, actually, when do we use AI against criminality? And Alex is right. And actually, at the lower level, open source level, actually, what you don't want to do is curtail that with so many regulations and audits and inspection processes that policing just can't move on. And you can't actually target the criminals who are doing that. At the serious and organised crime end, where we will be looking at using AI in a much more intrusive way and probably on a higher volume and scale, I do think there needs to be appropriate audit and inspection and governance functions around that that aren't run by policing, as there are now, and authorisation processes exactly the same as there are now. If you're going to go into highly intrusive tactics sometimes, there needs to be somebody other than the police who marks that homework and makes sure we're applying it correctly, so that we are doing this in as ethical a way as possible, whatever that ethical framework might look like in 2045, that we're still applying our good moral judgment, but actually it's done for good reason. It's proportionate to what you're investigating. You can justify it. And as Alex said right at the beginning, actually you'd need to be able to explain what you're doing and why you're doing it. So I think that all has to be there. Otherwise, anything that's unfettered and unchecked in policing is ripe for somebody somewhere to abuse it. And actually, we don't want that in policing. We've got to make sure that we legislate ourselves and govern ourselves in some respects to prevent that happening, but also bring in external people to make sure that our community and of the UK and elsewhere are confident in what we're doing, because it's not just about our communities, it's about our partners overseas who need to have confidence that the system works well and is subject to good scrutiny.
So I think there's a philosophical question to be had here, because there is sort of two standards. And if you think about how police uses its discretionary effort, if I say to my force, crack down on robbery, they'll go out and they go, right, who's our robbers? Who's good for this? Who do we need to follow, to knock on their doors, to look out for? And in each brain of an officer, there's the heuristics going on, which goes, it's normally he's good for this. And now that is subject to a huge amount of bias. There's stuff they don't know, there's intelligence, sometimes there's prejudice, all those things. And we have this slightly well-worn trope now for AI, bad data in, bad data out. But my view would be, if AI can improve the decision-making of an officer and make it less biased, it's still not going to be perfect, is it? But less biased than a human on their own, then that must be a good thing. But people seem happy with humans making decisions, less happy with computer or a machine informing a human to make better decisions. That, you know, there's a real scare in the system that goes, oh, that's terrible, forgetting that every day. Humans are making decisions and they're going to be hugely flawed.
Yeah, it's back to something we say a lot, you know, using AI to support a role rather than replace a role. You know, that's really important at the moment. You're not going to just rebuild a human and get that doing the same job. So if that context can be brought into policing, then that, you know, you can see where the operational benefits come from.
So let's talk about deepfake technology and that, obviously in the news again, just in terms of how we address that challenge. I don't know if you have any views on it, Chris.
In terms of how we address it, that's a huge challenge. I think it's a worrying trend at the moment. There's articles, as you say, Jason, today about increasing use of deepfake in sexual exploitation. Victims from 15, 20 years ago who are seeing images of themselves being rebranded effectively and circulated, and actually that trauma that comes with it every time that happens is significant. So there's a number of things I think we've got to look at. Is that there's a legislative framework to this as well, is that in terms of violence against the person and sexual offences against the person, that offence may have happened 15, 20 years ago, but what offences are being committed actually when those images are recirculated in terms of the violence against the individual, albeit in a virtual environment, not just the sharing of indecent images, but the violence against that person who is going through the trauma again. So I think there's a legal framework we've probably got to reconsider. We've also got to think about what intrusive kind of deterrent we want to put in terms of attacking servers and trying to prevent these images coming through in the first place. So how do you stop the marketplace, I suppose, and the sales point? Because sometimes we're not going to see who the individuals are behind this. As I say, they could be sitting behind multiple bots and artificially generated servers. It's going to be a real challenge. And then is there anything that can actually start to identify when you've got deepfake imagery and deepfake, and it's not just going to be that, it's going to be voices, all sorts that are just going to be used in frauds and scams and so on in the future. So how do we actually start putting some tools in the hands of individuals themselves to say, this is how you can protect yourself. Here's some tools that will identify when somebody is trying to scam you through deepfake voice imagery, whatever. The same as we would put alarms in houses, and you see Ring doorbells now, you know, and things like that, adding to security. What is it that we can put in that online environment that keeps people safe?
I think, Chris, we're in a sort of deepfake arms race where we've got Gen AI creating deepfakes. We've then got AI creating deepfake detection, and they are of a hugely variable standard and people don't necessarily understand them. And then we've got AI trying to defeat deepfake detection by recropping, repixelizing. And so already, you know, you've got one AI versus another AI versus another AI. And into the system, we operate within the criminal justice arena. And a criminal justice arena needs to demonstrate that the evidence you're placing before a court is genuine. And already there's a sort of rebuttable presumption in policing that this piece of technology is not fake. Here's CCTV of me in my alibi, or here's a WhatsApp account of me consenting, or, you know, here's some social media posts. And I don't know, but it could be a matter of time when we have to demonstrate before we do anything in a court of law that something is digital, and bearing in mind all crimes have a digital footprint now, is not faked. And that will probably counter a significant amount of the productivity gains we get from AI. So this is sort of uncharted territory and really, really complex, but with real potential victims at the end. As Chris said, you know, you can have an off-net on your laptop Gen AI program that could create a million images of children being abused. And if we get hold, well, A, we won't know because it's not online, but if we do get hold of it, how do we find out if they're real children or not? That's what we do at the moment, but it's a really interesting and difficult challenge for us.
Just a follow-on question from that. So we've seen in the kind of crypto and blockchain space, developers being held liable for certain frauds. Do you see a time where developers are actually responsible for the creation of the AI models that happen to cause the crime? Where does the accountability and liability lie there?
I mean, it's a really good question. And Jason, we might move on to sort of legal constraints, but another area I'd want to work with other chief constables with is putting refreshed legislation options together. And in old-fashioned policing, we call it going equipped, right? So you stop someone with the equipment to go in and commit a crime. I think if you've got a company that hasn't got adequate guardrails in place, then it's perfectly reasonable to ask questions. And those guardrails need to be protected, because we know anyone with a bit of coding experience and dark web access could de-guardrail a computer program and that should be protected as well. But I certainly do think it would be criminally irresponsible of a company to sell a large language model, for example, to a paedophile that doesn't have guardrails. You've got to design it out.
But I think it's a very real threat, and it's one that's here now. So there are individuals and small companies who actually create the tooling and will develop software that they then sell on, knowing it will be used for criminal purposes. They're not actually committing a crime themselves. They're just giving, this could be individuals anywhere in the world, people who wouldn't have the coding expertise themselves, to literally buy something off the shelf, put it on their own computer and go away and commit fraud or whatever crime they want. So the technology is being sold on to enable that. So I do think there's got to be a shift in some of the legislative framework and what that means, and the culpability of those individuals or those companies who are doing it, because that's the starting point for prevention and protection of our communities. Otherwise, it starts to become a cultural norm that actually this is okay to buy this because nobody's legislated against it, therefore I'm okay to buy it. And then people will unwittingly get into a world of criminality that they hadn't otherwise expected to be in. So it's not just about the kind of people who are selling it, it's about protecting the people who might actually buy it, not quite realising in some cases what they're buying and what it might do. Most will, but there will be some who stumble into it unwittingly. So how do we protect them and how do we stop this happening? But the legislative framework at the moment is just not there.
So Alex, talk us through a little bit more about the framework then, and about what you see as the work we need to do now in preparation for 2045.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things we've spoken about already, and it's probably to reassure listeners, is to say it is quite niche. So albeit it's out there, we are not seeing deepfakes being used as evidence to get people off with an alibi, for example. We're not seeing the mass adoption by criminals, the use of AI yet. What we're talking about is proofs of concept that one or two criminals might have used, and it might be growing, but it's not at a big scale. But it's right that we get ahead of the curve. So by 2045, in answer to your question, I think we'd have an agile and robust legislative framework that prevents the criminal use of AI as much as is feasibly possible, and that equips policing with the tools to tackle the criminal use of AI. And things do need to change. The normal views from groups that want to protect the citizens' right to privacy, that's hugely important, and we respect that. But similarly, we've got to prevent companies and individuals also intruding on people's right to life and right to go about their job without being subject to crime. And so no doubt there will be some compromises along the way, but we need a legislative framework that both, I think, supports the use of AI. I don't think we should run scared. If we run scared, we'll only be taken over. So certainly, I think Chief Constable's Council, we as policing must embrace the benefits of AI whilst being really cognizant of taking the community with us, doing it in a lawful way, but being equipped with the tools to tackle criminals who want to use AI.
A question we asked with other colleagues previously was about, should the public be worried by AI? I don't know if you've got a view on that, Chris.
I think the public should be aware of the risks. AI, actually, the vast bulk of it will be helpful. It's going to make things easier. It will lead to better decision making. It will lead to safer roads. It will lead to safer flights. It will automate the processes through airport. You start to think about your daily life and everything you do at the moment. It should make all of that a lot easier. But as with anything in life, there is always a risk if you're not aware of it. So the things I'd be saying to the public is, don't be frightened of it. Just be aware of some of the risks around the fact, and watch out for scams, watch out for fraud, watch out for the deep fake imagery and things like that that might come through, and think about what you're going to do to protect yourself. And I think this is where corporate social responsibility comes in as well, is what are companies doing and the private sector doing to help individuals? What's the banking sector going to do to protect people from that? It's like anything in life. Don't be frightened of it. Be aware of it. You've still got to go out there and live your life. And a lot of our lives now are going to be online. And in the future, 2045, if I look at the way my kids communicate with each other and their friends, I reckon 80, 85% of it is done through phones and machines. Well, that's probably only going to grow. So don't be frightened of it. Just be aware of it. Protect yourselves and think about how you're going to educate your children as well in terms of what the risk is there is online to them and what they can do to protect themselves in the future.
And Alistair, just again, just as we can come towards the end of this episode, in terms of, again, looking from outside policing, how do you think the wider public, the wider partners can help policing in terms of learning expertise
Well, I mean, I think definitely around the ethics, the policies, the kind of fair use, the deeper understanding of how to get the benefits of AI can certainly help the police. I think there's lots of the lessons learnt. I think private sector probably has the ability to test it a little further in the early days. So that learning coming back to the policing, I think, would be a useful mechanism to go, well, this works, that's, you know, beware of this. I think all of those kind of spaces, you can really get some community working on the whole thing. Interesting to what Chris was saying a minute ago. I think taking a step back from it, if you replaced AI with 20 years ago saying the same statement with online banking, it's the same scenario. It's new to us. It's a scary world, but it's only because we're not using it day to day. It will become the norm. So it's about getting everybody used to the risks of it, but the benefits. And that's always the same with banking when it went online.
So just to finish off, I asked it for colleagues this morning about crime in the future, and there's just one for yourself. So they had a lot more questions, but just one for yourself. RoboCop, fact or fiction?
Fiction.
Fiction?
Fiction. Going back to Alex's point right at the beginning, you're still going to need your police officers and your analysts out there. There's still the enforcement part of it. There's still going to be the checking around the transparency and the efficacy of what we're doing. Yes, we're going to be using machines more to automate things and to speed things up. So let's, you know, statements done quicker, things like that. But you're still going to need a human at the end of it who makes a judgment on, is this the right thing to do? Yes or no? One of the things we should be really proud of in the UK is that police officers have discretion. It is not a hard and fast, you will do this. There are ultimately, in most of what they're doing, they're dealing with human beings. There is going to be emotion involved. We're a million miles away from artificial intelligence that can interpret emotions and take the heat out of those situations. And there are still offences out there that policing will have to go to around drunkenness and violence and things like that. I don't see RoboCop in the future, but I do see automation helping us out hugely.
Alex, any different?
I take that get out clause, which means define what you mean by RoboCop. But RoboCop, the film, 100%, I don't think so. Certainly not by 2045 in any case. And it would be a slightly dystopian future if RoboCop came in as you and I envisage it. Semi-sentient robots with red eyes walking the streets, doing you for a verbal infraction and giving you a crypto fine, I think, of science fiction.
We can tell what your viewing is all about outside policing, can't we, Alex? So, look, as always, a massive thank you for your insight today. Really insightful. I recognise the challenges around this for yourself. So thank you for all your work that you're doing now and no doubt in the future. We will hopefully see 2045 and be able to say what was we right back in 21 years ago. As always, for me, this is about people. You touched on it already about this is about connecting all the people, whether it be the public, with the police officers, police staff, all the way through to, again, making sure we're working with a wider partnership. Your point, Chris, around corporate social responsibility is going to be key, isn't it, around the prevention piece and responsibility. But the important bit, you can't take away the human judgment interaction. And I think that's come very clear from the conversation we had today. So a massive thank you to Exception that's sponsoring these episodes. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast service. In the coming episodes, we're going to go into more detail around big data. We're going to talk about cybercrime and fraud. Until that time, be aware, don't be alarmed. Till next time, thanks for listening.
Thin Digital Line. Policing in the year 2045.